Beyond Barbarossa, Episode 75, Where We Are in 1944. Welcome to Beyond Barbarossa, the first English language podcast in the world to focus on the Eastern Front of World War II. I'm Scott Burry, podcasting from the Redbeard Studio on traditional Anishinaabeg Algonquin land, also called Ottawa, in the free, independent, and sovereign country of Canada. I'm joined in the studio by my indispensable assistants, Ragnar the Magnificent and Daisy the Danger Doodle. Say hi, guys. No? Yeah. Ragnar's the strong, silent type. Before we go on, please take a moment to hit that follow button on your podcasting app, or subscribe if you listen on YouTube. And check out the Patreon feed. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free episodes with images. The last couple of episodes have been a look at what's to come in this podcast in about a year, the Red Army's conquest of Berlin and the end of the war in Europe. So now I think it's a good time to get back to the narrative of Beyond Barbarossa, tracking the development of the Second World War on the Eastern Front 81 years later. No, Ragnar, do not press that button. So we're back with Ragnar being his usual helpful self. So as I said, the last couple of episodes have been a look at what's to come in this podcast in about a year, the Red Army's conquest of Berlin and the end of the war in Europe. And so now I thought it's a good time to get back to the narrative part of Beyond Barbarossa, tracking the progress of the Second World War on the Eastern Front with the 81-year delay, which means that since I'm recording this in May 2025, we're looking at May 1944. And as this is episode 75, and we're on the edge of some really important developments in the overall war, I thought it would make sense to do a recap to see how far we've come since the last recap that we did about episode 50. And we have come hundreds of miles. The previous 12 months saw sweeping changes on the Eastern Front as the Soviets pushed the Germans back from Stalingrad, the Caucasus Mountains, and the Volga River, all the way back to the pre-war borders in the south part of the front lines. In the north, the Red Army lifted the siege of Leningrad and pushed the Germans out of Russia proper to the Estonian border. 1943 and early 1944 also saw huge changes in other theaters of the Second World War, the Africa, the Mediterranean, the Pacific, China, and Indochina. As I've said before, August 1942 was the Axis's high water mark, which means that their fortunes began to ebb at that point. Okay, enough of the nautical metaphors. What I mean is that summer of 1942 was the time when the Empire of Japan reached its greatest geographical extent. It had even reached the Aleutian Islands, which is part of Alaska. But then came the Battle of Midway, when the Empire of the Sun lost 4 fleet aircraft carriers, a heavy cruiser, and hundreds of their best pilots. From that point, the Allies had the initiative in the Pacific, Of course, it would still take bloody battles with thousands of casualties for American, Australia, New Zealand, and other British Commonwealth forces to push the Japanese from Eniwetok, the Mariana Islands, the Aleutians, and New Guinea. In Africa, Rommel's Africa Corps won the first Battle of El Alamein and captured the besieged port of Tobruk in Libya in the summer of 1942, but their operation stalled at the Egyptian border or just past it, and by August, the Axis forces were back to their starting point in Libya. And on the Eastern Front in the summer of 1942, the Germans reached the Volga River, what the Nazis had defined as the edge of Asia, and they were on the northern slopes of the Caucasus Mountains. But that's as far as the Germans got. Speaking of the Volga River, the German 6th Army reached the city of Stalingrad in early August 1942. They pushed into the city, captured all the suburbs, and turned the great factories into piles of twisted metal and rubble. But they were never able to capture the entire city. The tide turned in November 1942 when the Red Army launched Operation Uranus, a huge initiative to surround the German 6th Army and its Axis friends in Stalingrad, and then destroy them. In November, 900 tanks, 1,500 warplanes, and over a million soldiers attacked through snow and ice fog. The Axis forces, including Romanian, Italian, Hungarian, and some Croatian units, were already dealing with overextended supply lines. Now they are completely cut off and surrounded. Field Marshal Hermann Göring, commander of the German Air Force, promised the Luftwaffe could supply the forces in Stalingrad by air, but the Luftwaffe never even came close to delivering what the huge army needed. In December 1942, German General Erich von Manstein led Operation Winter Storm, an attempt to break through the encirclement and rescue the 6th Army. As you know, it failed. The Red Army responded with Operation Little Saturn. They broke through the Hungarian and Romanian lines that protected that long salient, further isolating the 6th Army in Stalingrad. This operation eventually allowed them to retake Rostov-on-Don at the tip of the Sea of Azov. Starving and out of ammunition and nearly out of soldiers, the 6th Army surrendered on 31st January 1943. That very day, Hitler had promoted its commander, Friedrich Paulus, to the rank of Field Marshal. Paulus thus became the first and only German Field Marshal ever to be taken prisoner. This thwarted Hitler's punishment for Paulus. No Field Marshal had ever been taken prisoner, so promoting a trapped general to that level meant that Paulus was supposed to kill himself, and he knew that. He didn't. In fact, Paulus survived the war, and said he was then a fervent communist. There's a famous photograph of Paulus surrendering alongside his chief aides, which I've put on the webpage for this episode. Paulus had subjected himself to the same dietary restrictions as his men, which was well below the starvation level, and you can tell on Paulus. But back to the story. Estimates of casualties at Stalingrad vary widely. Some say about 800,000 Germans were killed, wounded, or captured, plus anywhere up to another 700,000 losses for the other Axis troops, the Hungarians, Italians, Romanians, and so on. Losses on the Soviet side were staggeringly greater. The Red Army numbered 1,347,214 killed, missing, wounded, or sick. And that number might not include members of the NKVD, the Soviet Security Service, which forerunner of the KGB. And that's because their records weren't very accurate and there was so much destruction that it just was impossible to do an accurate count. In addition to those numbers, the NKVD pushed thousands of civilians into what they called workers' militias, even less well-equipped than the Red Army. And most of them were killed. Stalingrad. It's been called the greatest bloodbath in human history. The numbers of casualties in Stalingrad, so we're in millions here, far exceed the totals at the First World War Battle of Verdun, which itself has been a watchword for bloody battles. From that point, in the winter of 1943, the Red Army had the initiative on the Eastern Front. Von Manstein's army group south, greatly reduced from the force that the same name that had invaded Ukraine in 1941, did manage to recapture Kharkiv, Ukraine in February 1943. But was that a victory? 86,000 German casualties, and they lost the city again in August 1943. The Red Army continued to suffer staggering losses throughout that year, and they usually lost a lot more, several times more than the Axis did. For example, in March 1943, the German generals finally got Hitler to agree to a strategic withdrawal from the Rzhev salient west of Moscow. This was a deep eastward or north and eastward bulge in the front lines, and I'll put a map on the webpage for this episode. It's tempting when you see a salient of your enemy sticking into your lines to attack it because you can get around it from three sides. And the Red Army had been trying to do so for 2 years. This became known as Rzhev meat grinder. The Red Army launched three major offenses on this salient, including Operation Mars in late fall 1942. The result was over 100,000 Red Army soldiers killed, 235,000 wounded, and the loss of 1,600 tanks, all for no advance. It was Soviet Marshal Georgi Zhukov's greatest failure. In all, the several attempts at the Rzhev meat grinder cost a million Soviet deaths. Until the Germans pulled back on their own in the winter of 1943 in Operation Buffel, or Buffalo. This strategic withdrawal took 3 weeks and included brutal attacks on the civilians in the salient. The Germans themselves suffered very few casualties. The operation allowed them to shorten their lines, making them easier to defend, and it freed up 20 divisions for fighting elsewhere where they were more needed. But it also cost them an important bridgehead that threatened Moscow, a place from which they could theoretically try again to capture the capital city. Those 20 divisions, where did they go? To the Kursk salient, another bulge in the lines, where they would be used in the greatest armored battle in history. You see, the fighting in Western Russia in the winter and spring of 1943 had left a bulge westward in the front lines, roughly centered on the city of Kursk. This time it was the Germans who decided to attack. As I covered in episodes 51, 52, and 53 last year, last summer, go back to that if you would like to, after you finish listening to this episode, that is. They started with a pincer movement, so two attacks at the northern and southern corners of the salient, and you can see what I mean in the map. The objective was to surround the two Red Army fronts, or groups of armies, in the bulge itself. However, the Soviets anticipated this. I mean, it's pretty obvious. You know your enemy wants to attack a salient, and they're going to, so they got ready. They built up their defenses, and boy, did they build them up. As a result, the German attacks stalled, and when they did, Konstantin Rokossovsky's Central Front and Nikolai Vatutin's Voronezh Front launched counterattacks. Historians characterized the ensuing battle as a strategic success for the Soviets, although most dispute the claims of a great victory at Kursk. The Soviets suffered up to 1,700,000 casualties and lost 6,000 to 7,000 tanks and assault guns, 3,300 aircraft, and more. Although the Germans were the initial attacking force and were greatly outnumbered, they lost a quarter of what the Red Army did. Still a huge number, 430,000 casualties. That's killed, wounded, sick, and missing, and captured. But compared to 1,700,000, they also lost 3,000 tanks that they could ill afford and nearly 700 aircraft. In the summer of 1943, there was a lot more going on the Eastern Front than Kursk. So let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll travel a bit farther south. Hi, Scott here. I hope you're enjoying this episode and that you get a lot out of the whole podcast. Beyond Barbarossa is still, as far as I can tell, the only English language podcast in the world that focuses on the Eastern Front of World War II. If you do like it and you want to help me keep it going, please give it a rating or a review on Apple, Google, Amazon, Podbean, or whatever podcasting platform you listen to it on. That helps let other people know about it. Patreon's another way you can support the podcast, my research, and podcasting expenses. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa and sign up at whatever level of support you choose. Patreon supporters get early, ad-free access to new episodes, as well as exclusive bonus episodes on topics like the Winter War between the USSR and Finland, and the pre-Barbarossa invasion of Poland by Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union in 1939. Check it out, won't you? Just go to patreon.com/beyondbarbarossa. Thanks.
Did you know that the cappuccino was invented by a Ukrainian? Or that many first names, like Philip and Agatha, were brought to Western Europe by Ukrainian princesses? Or that a Ukrainian was the first female given the rank of officer in a modern army? Well, if you didn't, and even if you did, you can learn more on my podcast, Wandering the Edge, a podcast about Ukrainian history with a spot of travel. And all in English. And if you like Beyond Barbarossa as much as I do, because, well, it makes my life a whole lot easier since I don't have to do any episodes deep diving into the Eastern Front of the Second World War, please take a listen to Wandering the Edge for a deep dive into Ukrainian history, culture, and tradition. Find out more on wanderingtheedge.net. And now let's get back to Scott exploring and explaining the Eastern Front of the Second World War.
Thanks for coming back to episode 75 of Beyond Barbarossa. We're looking at a recap of the war on the Eastern Front from May 1943 to May 1944. Even though the Germans didn't lose as much as the Soviets did in this attack, the result was the complete eradication of any remaining idea of German invincibility on the battlefield. From this point, the Wehrmacht was on the defensive, retreating, or at best, launching counterattacks across Ukraine. They would never be able to replace all that armor, all those vehicles, tanks, planes, and while they did manage to place more men in the field until 1944, their strength was ebbing on the Eastern Front. And meanwhile, the Soviets' strength was growing. We can attribute a lot of that to Lend-Lease, a program that delivered millions of tons of food, ammunition, equipment, including tanks and warplanes and other vehicles, and much more, from the West, largely from the United States. But at the same time, the Stavka, the Soviet high command, was bringing more and more men and women into the ranks of the Red Army. New divisions, even whole new armies. Now, while Kursk was still raging in July and August, the Red Army began an astonishing drive westward across Ukraine, starting in the Donbass, the easternmost part of the country. There, the southern and southwestern fronts, remember, fronts are Soviet groups of armies, began the first Donbass strategic offensive on 17 July 1943. They advanced west of the Mies River until they ran into 5 Panzer and Panzer Grenadier divisions along with the Luftwaffe's 4th Air Corps, and it stopped them. The Germans drove the Soviets back to their starting point in the eastern Donbass. They also inflicted about 100,000 casualties compared to 22,000 on their own side. Again, the Germans inflicted 4 times as many casualties as they suffered. While you can say, yeah, the Germans won this round, those divisions were unavailable for Kursk. On 3rd August, we're still in 1943 here, armies of the Voronezh and Steppe fronts attacked the northern flank of Army Group South, southeast of Kursk, in Operation Polkovodets Romyantsev, or General Rumantsev, named after a historic Russian general. This was also called the Belgorod-Kharkov Strategic Offensive. Close to 2 million soldiers, think about this, the Soviets have close to 2 million soldiers fighting in the Kursk salient, another 500,000 fighting in the Donbass. And still, they managed to bring 1.4 million more men and women, with another 2,418 tanks and 13,633 assault guns and rocket launchers, and they drove the Germans out of Belgorod in Russia and Kharkiv, Ukraine. This part is also known as the Fourth Battle of Kharkiv, and it would be the last time that city would change hands in the Second World War. And then, less than 2 weeks later, the same two fronts, the Southern and Southwestern fronts, launched another offensive in the same area. This time, the Soviets pushed the Germans past the Dnipro River, reaching the city of Dnipropetrovsk, which is now just called Dnipro, and Zaporizhia. This was more than 300 kilometers, or 200 miles, to the so-called Wotan defensive line. All this by the end of September. So whether you chalk it up to psychological, economic, military factors, or all of those together, the Red Army's edge was clear. And they didn't stop at the Dnipro. Almost immediately upon reaching the Great River, they crossed and set up bridgeheads, which did not go very far for quite a while, a couple of months. In November, the Red Army liberated, I'm using quotation marks here because it's hard to imagine the communists bringing liberty anywhere. I'll say this, they retook Kyiv, capital of Ukraine, on 6 November. So let's go up to 1944. In January, the Red Army began a series of what Joseph Stalin called 10 crushing blows against the Germans. First, the Leningrad and Volkhov fronts finally lifted the siege of Leningrad after 900 days. Actually, 890-something, but 900 sounds better. The Red Army also pushed the Germans farther west, past the ancient city of Novgorod, all the way to the Estonian border. The next crushing blow was the Dnipro-Carpathian Offensive, which actually started on Christmas Eve 1943, so it was kind of the first, but it took longer to end than the first one. Anyway, this pushed the Axis forces out of northwestern Ukraine all the way to the pre-war border of Poland and the foothills of the Carpathian Mountains. Vatutin's Voronezh Front, renamed the First Ukrainian Front, and Ivan Konev's Step Front, now the Second Ukrainian Front, trapped the remnants of the German 8th Army, part of Army Group South, in an area between Cherkasy, on the right or west bank of the Dnipro, and Korsun. Manstein sent another rescue force toward the encirclement as the trapped forces escaped westward. They did manage to escape the encirclement eventually, but both sides, German and Soviet, suffered immense casualties. You can get all the details on this in episode 67, The Red Army Has the Momentum. Boy, did they ever. More crushing blows would follow. The Red Army then retook Crimea, crossed the Dnipro in the south, and pushed the Axis all the way back to Odessa. And they kept going, out of Odessa, past it to the borders of Moldova and Romania. These operations put the Soviets in control of all Ukraine, a situation that would persist for another 5 or 6 decades. But that's a story for a different podcast. Which brings us up to May 1944. With 3 of 10 crushing blows delivered, 7 more to go. Now, I know what you're asking. Wait a minute, what else is happening in the war? Don't worry, I didn't forget. So let's take a look at the rest of the war in the spring of 1944. Head over to the Far East. In March 1944, the long-range penetration groups, also called the Chindits, commanded by British Brigadier Ord Wingate, were making forays against the Japanese in Burma and having great success. The Japanese began an attempt to invade British-controlled India in March 1944. This was a battle that would rage for 4 months at the Burmese-Indian border near the city of Imphal. At the same time, other Japanese units attacked U.S. forces near Bougainville in the Solomon Islands in the Pacific. So you've probably heard of Bougainville and the Solomons. The Third Battle of Monte Cassino in Italy began in March, destroying the town of Cassino itself. On 12th March, the Germans occupied Hungary to prevent the country from making a separate peace with the Allies, or even joining the Allies. In April 1944, the Japanese launched an attack in central Henan in eastern China to try to capture U.S. air bases and secure overland supply routes through China and French Indochina. By the end of the month, British and Indian troops defeated the Japanese at Imphal on the Burmese-Indian border. And at this point, April-May 1944, the Canadians, British, and Americans are furiously busy with their preparations for Operation Overlord. Don't worry, we'll get to that soon. Now, looking at the clock, and I'm sure you'll agree, that's plenty for one episode. Join me again in 2 weeks for a closer look at an army that hasn't received enough attention in this podcast, nor even generally, especially here in the West. The Polish Home Army. You don't want to miss it. Thank you for listening to this episode of Beyond Barbarossa, the podcast about the Eastern Front of the Second World War. Don't forget to hit that follow button. And if you're listening on YouTube, I'd really appreciate it if you'd hit subscribe. If you have a moment, please leave a rating on whichever podcasting platform you listen on. That really helps other people find Beyond Barbarossa if they don't know about the only English language podcast that focuses on the whole Eastern Front of World War II. As usual, I put maps and photos on the webpage for this episode, beyondbarbarossa.ca or beyondbarbarossa.podbean.com. I want to thank all of you who support the podcast through Patreon. Tom Gaffney, Nicholas Thomas, William L. Hall, Gavin Edwards, Elliot Goldman, PFE, Craig Duncan, Bill Hall, Ed Morley, Frog, Claude Jansen, Sydney Tobias, and Bruce. And welcome to the latest members, Stephen Hunt, Daniel Seide, I hope I pronounce that correctly, Juice van der Enden, Jihad A.R., David Burns, Kevin Milan, Oz, Zoran Todeslevic, I hope I pronounce that one correctly as well, and Kevin. Do you have something to say, a comment, question, or, and as I said before, I hate to admit the possibility of this, but I am only human, a correction? Please let me know. Reach out by email, scott@beyondbarbarossa.ca, or through the Facebook Beyond Barbarossa page. You can also find me on Blue Sky, Scott the Writer, Threads, and Instagram. I'm looking forward to hearing from you. Remember, everyone, Canada is a free, independent, sovereign country. We will never be the 51st part of anything. Original music was composed and recorded by Nicholas Burr. I'm Scott Burr. Till next time, keep your paddles in the water. Slava Ukraini. Vive Canada.